Obviously, it would be tremendously useful to have a group of trained soldiers who can see inside secret bases, bend enemy weapons from a distance, and cause designated targets to fall over dead, all through the power of mind. Some of you will be aware that the US and Soviet military and intelligence agencies both investigated the use of psychic spies and paranormal powers for covert use. It turned out there was a pretty big gap between the cinematic X-Men type powers and the actual performance of this real group. Somewhere between Magneto bending a tank turret and an Israeli magician bending a spoon lay spectacular hopes that psychic superpowers might someday play a part in the war between government superpowers.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
This is Monster Talk, the science show about monsters.
I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
In this episode, we're pleased to bring you an interview with psychologist Ray Hyman, a longtime skeptical activist and educator, a founding member of PsyCop, now CSI, and one of the key investigators into the U.S. government's program to develop psychic soldiers. Some of this story was revealed in John Ronson's great book, The Men Who Stare at Goats. But in this interview, you'll hear Ray's personal recollections about magic, skepticism, and the mysterious claims of a famous psychic named Uri Geller. In a timely coincidence, as I was preparing this episode, the Daily Mail released several stories about the alleged psychic spy work of Uri Geller. We'll hear more about the fascinating Mr. Geller in this interview. Ray mentions a lot of books and people and ideas in this interview, and I try to link to many of them in the show notes, so you can check those out at monstertalk.org. Now, I'm not going to pretend that psychic soldiers are monsters. I suppose they could be monstrous. But just for a long time, I thought this was a fascinating story. And when Karen arranged for us to have this interview, I felt it was too good of an opportunity to pass up. And I hope you enjoy what follows. Don't worry, Ray does have a favorite monster. Oh, one more thing. There's a few places in the interview where I have to reconstruct the questions because some of the technical issues we had when we recorded. This was the most technically challenging interview we've done that actually turned out okay. Unfortunately, this loss included Karen's first question, which was, how did Ray get started with cold reading? We start the interview with that.
Monster Talk.
I'm a magician, but people paid me more to do a mental show. So, and I got more work that way. So I'm doing mentalism. And I was always, since I was stuck... I couldn't travel much because I was also a student. So I had to pitch myself to the same groups, same organizations every year. And that meant I need to change my act or add to my act so I wasn't repeating myself to the same group. And so I was looking around for new things to do. I did tried hypnotic demonstrations. I did a memory act, all usually as to supplement my mentalism act. And finally, I got to the point where I discovered that when I was doing a mentalism act, even doing magic, every once in a while I would give one of the people in the audience a little short little reading. I would tell them about themselves, a little cold reading. And to my surprise, people always... That was the biggest hit of my show all the time, even though I was doing this fancy magic and fancy other stuff. They always talked about the cold reading. You know, that was just a throwaway for me. So I realized, hey, that's something I should be able to exploit. So I looked around for something to, you know, some sort of a thing like astrology or something I could, you know, attach the cold reading to. And the only thing that made sense to me was palmistry. So I read some books on palmistry, and then I was in business.
And so you never really believed in the paranormal aspects of palm reading, did you? You just thought that initially there might have been something to the theory.
You're right. I didn't believe anything paranormal about it. But the possibility to me was that at least it's plausible. because it's attached to the, you know, reading something from the person's hands. And I had read in some of my palmistry books, but then I checked it out, that there are diseases and a few other things experts can tell from someone's hands. So that added to the plausibility that maybe we could tell people a lot of other things from their hand as well. So I went to the library and got some books out of the library on palm reading. I learned it, and I then put up my shingle and was in business. I, very first person to come, usually I do these affairs. Very first person I did, she just was delighted. And I was reading everything direct, you know, as it should be. In other words, the lines on the hand. I already knew that most readings depend on using generalities which people can fit to themselves. But I was throwing in, because the palm book reading books said you could do that, I was throwing in also aspects about their health, and you could date it also. Let's say that I was looking at the headline, and I saw a break in a person's headline. You can date it using the palmistry techniques that I had been reading about. Let's say they had a break in their headline age around age 40. So I would tell them that something happened dealing with your brain or something. Did you have a brain aneurysm or something like that at around 40 years of age? Or did you fall out of a tree and hit your head? And I was amazed, to me, it seemed to me that a lot of people reacted surprised and validated these rather specific statements I was throwing into my regular palm reading. And that got me thinking that maybe there's something to it. So I'm not sure I ever fully believed it, but I could defend it. And I think I told Karen a story about how my psychology professor, the head of the psychology department when I was an undergraduate, heard I was reading palms for money, and he called me into his office, and he gave me a dressing down. He said, "Don't you know that this is just pure, pure nonsense? There's no validity to palm reading, and you're taking money under false pretenses. What a nasty thing you're doing, and it's a shame," and stuff like that. And he went on and on and on, and I let him go. And he finally he stopped, and I said simply, "Can I see your hand?" So he put his hand in front of me, and I gave him a reading. He didn't say anything, but I left. But a few weeks later, I got a note from him saying, "Could you come to see me again?" So I came, and we went into his office. He shut the door, and he sat down in a chair and put both hands out and says, "Tell me more."
Wow.
I think that's a great anecdote showing how powerful cold reading is.
Yes, I love cold reading because, to me, it's the ideal context in which to understand all of deception and all the things that skeptics are trying to expose or deal with. But to the cold reading embodies everything that's necessary to know about why smart people can go wrong. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I love cold reading. That's why I give the workshops on cold reading at Randy's and other places. And to me, it can't go wrong. You know, I always think, boy, you know, I'm going to be in television again. They want me to do a cold reading. What if I fail? What if, you never know. Maybe I get a very recalcitrant person they give me, and they're gonna say, "No, that's not me." It's never happened. And I think I did my first cold reading on television back in the Dumont Network when I was a graduate student. I think it was about 1952 or something like that. And I've given cold readings mostly palm reading, but I've done other kinds where you just stand up and look at people. And I've done that many, many times on various TV shows. I even have videos of several of them and I put together for my workshops, sometimes I put together a selection of my readings that I show them to show them what cold reading is and how powerful it is. But so far, And I've been, as I said, I'm 88 years old now, and I've been doing palm reading since I was 16.
Wow.
I don't recall anyone ever saying, hey, that's not me.
So how did you go from being a palm reader to becoming a skeptic?
Oh, I was a skeptic before I was a palm reader. I was a skeptic from age 7 onwards. I don't ever remember not being a skeptic. And the way that came about was that at age 7, I did my first magic show for money. And that happened because my father gave me a few magic tricks, the kind you should buy in a joke shop, for my 7th birthday. So I worked with them, and then I took them to school, and I did them for the show and tell. And the teacher must have thought it was cute or something, because she asked me, would I be willing to do that for the Parent Teachers Association meeting? I said, yes. And so I did it, and they gave me $5. Now, that was back in 1945. So, yes, 1945, I think. No, 1935, actually. So that's how far back it was. So that was a lot of money then. And I was able to go to a printer with that $5 and ask him to make me some business cards, and he did. He did a very nice job. I lived on the Mystic River, so he called me the Merry Mystic. That was his idea. He put a rabbit and a hat on my card, and then my name and how to contact me. I distributed those cards all over the city, and I got a call from the library, and they had me come and do a magic show for the library for the story hour. And I got other magic shows, and from then on in, I was on my way. What happened was, there was a little library down the street from where I lived, down the hill, and it was a branch of the major public library. And I usually was the only one in that library, I know, and the librarian, she always was looking out for good books that I might read. And when I told her I was doing magic, she got hold of a book to give me to read. It's a children's book, but it was on the life of Harry Houdini, the great magician. And I read that, and that's the first time I heard of Houdini. But the one thing that stuck with me was that not only was Houdini a great magician, but he spent most of his career debunking spirit mediums and fakes and psychics of all kind. And I took it for granted that that's what a magician. If I'm going to be a magician, I have to be a debunker. I have to go around and exposing fakes. And so, as far as I can remember, I always was a skeptic.
Well, so how important is being, because I've heard Randy talk about this, but how important is being a magician or having magical training when you're trying to find trickery and deception when you're doing these sort of parapsychology research studies?
Well, here's where my good friend and I, my good friend Randy and I differ completely. And we've talked about this with each other a lot. He believes that he insists that you need a magician. If you're testing a psychic, you need a magician to be by your side. Because a magician will see things that the scientist or whoever is testing the psychic will not see. And I disagree completely. I'd say over half the magicians who encounter a psychic, like Uri Geller, for example, are completely taken in by it. Geller was supported, and still is, has the support of a lot of famous magicians. So magicians are not necessarily the best people to see trickery by a fake psychic. Randy is good at that because he's good at a lot of other things. He's not more than just a magician. He's an all-around scholar, actually, self-educated, but he knows about everything. And so because he can do it and see it, it doesn't mean that other... In fact, I know a lot of cases where scientists and fellow psychologists have called in a magician to help them when they're dealing with a psychic, and the magician has been taken in. So I don't go along with the idea that just because someone is a magician that they can spot trickery. In fact, magicians, I go to conventions, magic conventions we have every year all over, and every time I'm in a group of magicians, they're able to fool each other. So magicians can easily fool one another because they know how I know how their minds work and they know how my mind works. You know, we know what we're looking for. Once I know what you're looking for, I can lead you down a garden path. And so magicians easily fool one another, and they can be taken in by Uri Geller. In fact, I would say there's half of a lot of the great supporters of Uri Geller were magicians. They were just taken in completely by him.
You had an encounter with Uri Geller, didn't you, back in the 1970s? You were asked to investigate him?
Oh, yeah, I had several encounters. He and I are sort of good friends, and you might say by now. I don't know. Randy would not like me to say that. Geller is more than just a faker to Randy. Randy hates them with a passion. So it's a lifelong, because he thinks that Geller is the evilest of evil. But I like Geller in a way. You know, he's a wonderful, very accommodating, charming con artist.
He seems very charismatic. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he is charisma. That's what he has. He's charisma. He's improved. But when I first encountered him, he was a pretty bad magician, but he was a very good charismatic guy. He didn't have to be good because he could sell himself anyway. But I encountered him, and I was the first one in this country to encounter him. He was brought here from Israel by a man named Puharich, who was character in his own right. He's a medical doctor, but he was traveling around looking for psychics, and he encountered Geller in Israel, and he took Geller to the United States and brought him to the Stanford Research Institute to be tested, and that's when I got involved. I was grading exams. This is 1972, I remember it very clearly. I was grading final exams at the University of Oregon, sitting in my office, and I get a call from Colonel Austin Kibler. Kibler, I knew him because he was also a PhD psychologist, and we knew each other. Kibler then was acting head of ARPA, the Advanced Research Projects Agency of the Defense Department. It's now called DARPA, Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. But that agency was set up by President Kennedy to be sort of like the Buck Rogers or Flash Gordon, part of the Defense Department, to deal with innovative new techniques and futuristic things and far out things that may have some import for the Defense Department. Colonel Kibler called me because he wanted me to drop whatever I was doing and go immediately to the Stanford Research Institute to investigate some psychic they had there. And he says, "I know what you're thinking, Ray. I know that you're skeptical and you don't believe it, and psychics at all. But this guy is more than just an ordinary psychic. He can do everything every other psychic can do, plus he does more. Like he bends metal with his mind." And I had this image of the Defense Department hoping that Geller would sit down there and bend Soviet. At that time, the Soviet Union was still intact. And I had this image of the Defense Department hoping that Geller would sit down in Stanford Research Institute and concentrate and bend Soviet tanks or something like that.
Sure, yeah.
Anyways, I told him I couldn't go down right away. I was grading exams. And then also, this was unusual, but an ice storm had taken over the whole ice coast, including West Coast, all the way down, including California, where Stanford Research Institute was. But he said, no, Ray, this is important. We want you to go down right away. And I says, why does it have to be so right now? And he said, because he said, Geller, this guy, Uri Geller, you know, he's a very temperamental guy. But also, some group is planning to do a life of his, a musical based on Geller on Broadway called the, what it's going to be like, what it's like to be a psychic who can bend metal. Okay, and we're going to do this musical. And he might leave any moment from the lab there and go to Broadway to work with those people. So he says, I need you to go down right away. Turned out that he wanted me to go because he's going to have a three-man committee go down, say, to represent the Defense Department to look at what Geller is doing. And He was going to send a parapsychologist because he felt if Geller really has psychic powers, it's going to take a parapsychologist to see it. On the other hand, he was very concerned that if Geller is a phony, fake, it'll take someone like me to see it. And the reason he was very concerned about that was because there was a Senator Proxmire at that time. I don't know if you ever heard of him. But Senator Proxmire was very famous for every year giving his Golden Fleece Awards.
Sorry to interrupt here, but this is Blake. At this point in the interview, Ray was going to talk about the Golden Fleece Awards of Senator William Proxmire, which he awarded to highlight what he saw as misuse of public funds, which was a play on both the terms fleecing, meaning to rip off someone, and an allusion to the mythical Golden Fleece. Unfortunately, at this point, my computer rebooted itself. We were unable to get Ray's call reconnected for about 10 minutes, and when we did get reconnected, we lost the end of Ray's comments regarding this controversial bit of American history. So I have put a link in the show notes if you'd like to learn more about Proxmire's Golden Fleece Awards, and we'll get back to Ray's interview now.
Research Institute, and before I went there, I had called a deal with a man named Russell Targ, who was one of the two physicists who was studying Geller, and he called me and told me that I would be allowed to come in to the lab, but I must not tell Geller I'm a psychologist or a magician, because he would just back up and just go. He can't tolerate magicians or psychologists in his audience watching him. So I was told, just say you're a representative of the Defense Department and don't mention that either of those two things. So I went down there. We met with this man, Van der Castle, who was the parapsychologist from the University of Virginia Medical School, actually. University of Virginia Medical School had a parapsychology department, mostly because they had a man named there, Stevenson, who dealt in reincarnation. But I didn't know they had a whole department, and they had other people. This other guy was Van der Castle, was his name, Robert Van der Castle. So he was the parapsychologist. Then they had a man, George Lawrence, who represented the Advanced Research Agency of the Defense Department. So we were in a three-man committee. And so when we got there, the physicists, two physicists were Russell Targ and Harold Puthoff. And they eagerly showed me a lot of their data that they collected on Geller and explained what was going on. But they pointed out he's very temperamental. And also, we'd be lucky if we saw anything really worthwhile the first day we were with him, because he's very erratic. And when new people come in, he suddenly can't do anything. And so it's up in the air what's going to happen. And while we were talking, I should have mentioned that one of the reasons that I went was because the colonel who sent me there told me that, look, I know, Ray, you don't believe this stuff, but let me tell you one of the things he did in my presence. We were out at Sanford Research Laboratory, and Geller asked to borrow someone's ring. And he said, don't let me touch it, though. And he had the person put the ring in the middle of the table that was in the laboratory room. And we all stood around the table, but kept back, backed up from the table. So no one's even touching the table. And when Geller concentrated, the ring stood on the end, split in two. That was split and shaped itself into the letter S. And
that's impressive. But
yeah.
I thought it was very impressive, too. So I'm going to want to see that. Mm-hmm. So when I got there, the very first thing I did, I said, they were telling me all the stories about what Geller does and showing me some of their records. But I said, I kept asking him about this thing about the ring that he meant without touching it. And I said, where did this happen? And do you have the ring? And so on. And they said, oh, don't worry, he can do it. I said, can he do it without touching it? And he said, he can do it either way. He can, sometimes we give him a ring or something to bend, and he has to go to the bathroom. And by the way, Randy called this urinalysis. lots of times he would go, he had trouble bending his foot on that, so he has to run off to the bathroom to put it under running water. So anyway, they said he could do it either way. And I kept pushing him. They got very annoyed with me. I said, well, who you had the ring? He said, oh, yeah. So they brought me a cup and the ring that he apparently bent. And it wasn't a ring that people wear in their finger. It was a ring that for some machinery that they do at Stanford Research Institute, they use these brass rings or whatever they are. But I don't know what they use for, but they use them a lot there. And this was a ring, the shape in a letter, like a letter O, but it was compressed. So it was now like a number 8. And I said, you know, it would take pretty good strength, but it was doable the way I looked at it, that thing. But I said, did you see him bend this? And it turned out after a lot of conversation, they were all evasive. They hadn't seen him bend that. They'd given it to him and showed it to him, and he took it home, and they came back the next day, and it was bent.
How can science explain this?
not so impressive.
So I wasn't very impressed, apparently. But I said, and every time I said, did you ever see him do it without touching it? And he said, we could do it either way. And I kept pushing him. I said, well, show me something. Tell me, do you have anyone here who actually saw him do it without touching it? And turned out they hadn't. And ultimately, it took a lot of, they really got annoyed with me, but I kept pressing. And ultimately, it turned out that no one there had ever seen him bend it without having getting his hands on it. And sometimes without not only getting his hands on it, but going away into the bathroom or something with it. And coming out and showing it was bent. It turned out that they took his word for it. Everything he did in that laboratory, in fact, they did with us too, for our committee, he would do it and say, you know, usually it's much bigger than this when I do it. This is just I don't know how to even count that, you know. So he'd bend the spoon a little bit, and there was, he had a little bend in it. But he said, oh, usually many times when I'm in a public place, stuff like that, it bends and bends and it does all kinds of crazy things. And I now know, after knowing Geller for quite a while and how he works, he says the same thing when he's in public, on, like the Johnny Carson show or something. He says, oh, you know, don't count this, it's too small a bend. When I'm in a scientific laboratory, I get better at it. I get better results. When he's in a scientific laboratory, he tells the scientists, oh, when I'm in the public, I get a better result. So he's a lot of talk, very compelling. He's a charismatic guy, and it's hard not to dislike him, I guess. The only one who really dislikes him with a passion is Randy.
Yeah, they've got a long past.
But, how does Geller fit in with the whole Project Stargate or Stargate Project and the military's use of psychic soldiers? Is he directly involved with that, or was that a separate thing?
He claims to be. No, he wasn't. Even though that also was carried out at Stanford Research Institute, he was never part of any of that.
Interesting. But you were, right? I mean, you had a role in that as well.
Yes, I was Stargate Project. I think it was 1995. What happened there was that in the early 1970s, I think it was, the CIA gave money to Stanford Research Institute, the same ones who were studying Geller. By the way, that was going on simultaneously with the study of Geller, but Geller wasn't part of the CIA project, to do remote viewing, to study remote viewing. That was a term that Russell Targ made to talk about just what we would call clairvoyance. By remote viewing was they would have these people who would lie down on a couch or something like that and presumably transport their astral body to some other place and be able to describe what was going on in that other place. And so Targ and Puthoff began doing a series of, for the CIA, they began doing a series of studies just, and what they would do, for example, they would give a remote viewer the coordinates of a place in the Soviet Union, for example, where they were interested in knowing what was going on. And you know, viewer would lie down or go into a trance, whatever, and then began describing whatever came to their minds. And they felt they got some rather dramatic hits. They gave examples, one case where the first one they tried even, they were, the United States was interested in a place that their, these high-flying airplanes had seen some activity going on in this place, but they couldn't see what was going on inside. They saw some big cranes. And so their first remote viewer, they hadn't been remote viewing, and they claim he went into his kind of a trance or whatever he goes into, and then said he saw the big cranes, but then he saw something else under there, and he said, described a few things there, and supposedly he had some great hits. And that was how they sold the CIA on us. That was a test for the case. When the CIA saw what he did with this Russian place, they decided to go whole hog, and they gave money to Stanford Research Institute to study to remote viewing. And that went on for a number of years. They spent about $7 million, I think, for that first few years, and they produced data, and they ultimately published some of it, and that was torn apart by it was just horrible stuff. David Marks in New Zealand, that he now lives in London, psychologist in New Zealand, he tried to replicate, when he first heard about these experiments at SRI, he tried to replicate the remote viewing experiments, especially the ones that they published, which got highly significant results. And they couldn't get any of it. You know, they believed it, you know, but they couldn't get it. Whenever they did it, they just found nothing. So David Marks came over to the United States. In fact, I got him a temporary appointment at the University of Oregon so he could live while he was here. So he came from New Zealand to the United States and stayed with me, actually. And then he went down to Stanford Research Institute and wanted to see their data. And they went there and look at it. And he had a terrible time. He spent a lot of time trying to get hold of it. He couldn't. Finally, he got friendly with one of the judges. And the judge had the data that he could look at. And he looked at those data. He took that back to New Zealand with him, and he did experiments, and he showed that when you edit, but for example, the remote viewer would say things. They would do they would send a team out from Stanford Research Institute while the remote viewer was closeted with Russell Targ at Stanford Research Institute, and they would go to some target place and wander around, and the remote viewer supposedly would say, oh, I see some water, I see some towers, and stuff like that. And then they'd come back, and they'd all take the remote viewer with them, and they'd all go back to the actual target and see how close the target was to what the reviewer had said. And they thought some great matches. But they then did a statistical analysis, and it came out highly significant that this was not chance. These people were actually picking up data. But David Marks, doing the same thing, couldn't repeat any of that. So he got this judge, I'm trying to remember his name now, but he became friendly with one of the people who had been the judge for the remote viewing experiments, and this man had kept copies of all the protocols. Let me give you an example. They would have, for let's say this particular remote viewer they're testing, they would give him, test him on 7 days, let's say, and the first day there'd be a target that the target team went out to. The second day there'd be a second target, and so on. Let's say the first day was the Hoover Tower at Stanford University. The remote viewer would describe a lot of different things, including the tower, which is a very prominent fixture in that area, and they would say that's a good match. That matches that particular target description matches the Hoover Tower, and they would go on and click that several days in a row. But what David Marks found was that there are clues from one day to the other. For example, in the protocol, the person, like Targ or one of the people, whoever was sitting with the remote viewer, he would say to the remote viewer, now, how does that compare with the Hoover Tower that we were looking at yesterday? Well, that already gives the judge a clue as to the fact that this very first, they were numbered, very first target that the remote viewer had to work with was the Hoover Tower. And so on. He found all kinds of clues like that. When he removed those clues and gave his judges in New Zealand the task of matching the targets to the protocols, it was his chance. And on and on it went. By the way, a lot of this work, if you're really interested in the best work on this, destroying all the remote viewing work, is a book by David Marks. The name skips me now, but it was published by Prometheus Bet Books. It's got solid chapters on all this remote viewing and tears their all that stuff apart completely. Well, they went on from, after Targ and Putoff stopped doing their work. It was taken over by one of the people that had been working there.
Book by David Marks is called The Psychology of the Psychic.
That's right, The Psychology of the Psychic, right.
Okay.
Excellent. It's devastating. His book tears apart everything that's been done on remote viewing. Very good. It's the best complete expose of it all. In other words, showing that none of it works at all. Even the best work that they was later done by the Ed, oh boy. But anyways, the guy who succeeded with Targ and Putoff, and he carried out a whole series for the, this, by the way, the CIA, in the first 5 years of the program, decided that it wasn't working for them, so they dropped it. And the DIA, the Department of Intelligence, the Defense Intelligence Agency, took over. And they were running the program until 1995, I think it was, because that's when I was called in. The CIA, oh, what happened was there was the remote viewers that they had, I think, so at any moment, at one time during that period, they had about, the Army had about 5 to 10 remote viewers, and they were housed at a fort in not far from Washington, D.C. So that's where they were based. But a general was in command of them, and a fight developed between the general and the remote viewers. They felt he was asking them to do things which they're not supposed to, they're not doing. He wasn't appreciative that the psychics have, you know, they don't deal with quantities. For example, he was asking him to remote view the nuclear installations in the North Korea. And they balked because they said, we're psychics. We don't deal with quantities. We deal with images and stuff like that. And so they complained, and this fight between the general who commands them and the remote viewers got to the Oversight Committee of the Senate. And in its wisdom, the Oversight Committee decided, we'll take the remote viewing project away from the DIA and put it back with the CIA. Well, the CIA didn't want it anymore. They didn't want it, but they didn't want to displease the Oversight Committee of the Senate. That could have some budget repercussions and stuff. So in their wisdom, they decided what we'll do is we'll set up a blue ribbon panel which will evaluate all the research to see whether it's worth our taking over or whether we should drop the whole business. And the blue ribbon panel turned out to be me and Jessica Utz. Jessica Utz is a parapsychologist. She's a good statistician. She's now at University of California, Irvine, but she was then at University of California, Davis. She's a good parapsychologist. We're good friends in some ways, but she's a good statistician. She, according to my friend Percy Diaconis, who is a top-notch statistician. So I always would tell her that she is a good statistician, but she knows nothing about data. And garbage in is garbage out. So if you do statistics to data that already is compromised, you're just going to get garbage. And she was very insulted by that. But anyways, we were asked to review the whole 20 years program, and I had in my basement, I maybe still have, maybe I threw it out finally, but I had three cartons of data. Everything was put out by the remote viewing project at this Stanford Research Institute. But also, what there were three projects going on simultaneously, part of the bigger project. So what the government had been doing, using the various uses the government had been making on remote viewers. So that was the operational part of the program. And the third part of the program was what information we had about what the Soviets were doing. A Senator Claiborne Pell, for example, wanted to have a big project, like the Manhattan Project, for to help the United States get caught up on psychic warfare. He called it the Psy Gap. And it was the Russians were 20 years ahead of us in applying remote viewing and other psychic techniques to warfare and other important aspects, intelligence gathering. And we had to catch up with them. So we wanted to have this big project. And by the way, one of the parts of the program, of this program, as I said, there was the operational part, there was the research part being done at Stanford Research Institute, but then there was the part where they kept tabs on the Soviet Union, what the Soviet Union was doing. They had spies and stuff like that, presumably. And I was told that, knowing I was a skeptic, they said, well, do you see what we have, the information we have what the Soviet Unions are doing with remote viewing and psychic, applying psychic techniques to warfare? You change your mind. But the problem was, it was so secret that I didn't have clearance. Well, it took me 3 months. I finally got clearance. And I was able to finally go see the secret stuff we had and what the Soviet Union was doing. I can't believe it. It was just horrible. The very best thing. First of all, I had to go to Fort Lewis, I think it is. I had to go there where they kept the records as well. That was where they had remote viewers, too. But they kept the records on what the Soviet Union was doing. I was told that once I went in there, I had to be accompanied by, this case, he was a lieutenant colonel, and I know him now. He lives in Las Vegas. Every time I go to Las Vegas for a convention, he always shows up. But he was a gung-ho psychic believer who headed a musician's project at that same fort. He told me that he can't, you know, he's got to be very careful what he does with the budget he's spending on testing munitions, but he's allowed, they have a rule that if you give less than $10,000, you don't have to document the details of what it's going for. And so he was then supporting a man who was a lie detector expert, but who also was doing psychic research in the sense of plants. He was the guy who started that craze in the, I think, the 60s of talking to plants. He was, as a lie detector guy, on a whim, he put a lie detector on a leaf of a philodendron. And then when he found that the philodendron showed typical emotional reactions when some brine or some other living stuff was murdered, that you poured hot water on it in another room or even in another building, it would show a reaction. And that started the whole craze of talking to plants and stuff like that. Well, this lieutenant colonel was supporting that guy by giving him $10,000 a month. He gave him $120,000 a year, whatever he's giving him to do his research. He would have to account for that, and that would be a no-no because his budget was only supposed to be used for testing munitions. But he was able to, because you didn't have to document what you did up to $10,000, you give him $10,000 a month, and so that's how we were supporting him. Now I've lost my train of thought.
I've got your book, The Elusive Quarry, and that book's about 30 years old now, I guess. And in that book, you talk a lot about the need for protocol tightening and removing biases in these sort of paranormal psychic studies. Is that still the predominant problem in psi research?
No, but we know more about it now. And I have a bigger model I'm working on about how people can... how smart. I've done a lot of work on how smart people can go wrong. I've done... there was a book put out, actually, by Robert Sternberg, edited a book on why smart people can be so stupid. That's what he called the book. And he got experts from all over to write chapters for the book. And then he sent me all the chapters and asked if I would read them all and then write an overall, overarching chapter for the beginning of the book to cover it all, you know. And that's what I did. And so that's when I called Why Smart People Can Go Wrong, I think, whatever. But anyways, it tries to pull together. I try to pull together all the what the other experts had to say about that, but then pointed out what they had missed, because they weren't using examples from like the Piltdown Man or like from the psychic world, you know, the claims that from and so I use a lot of examples like that to bring out the reasons why smart people can go wrong. But basically, it's very simple. When we mean smart, we're talking about something like intelligence, which is a measure of capacity. It's how much capacity people have to handle certain kinds of abstract ideas and information. But what is important in the world that we work in is how we use our capacity, what we use it for. And so the whether someone is rational or irrational is independent of whether they're smart in the sense of being having a high capacity, because having a high capacity doesn't mean you're going to use it or you're going to use it properly. And it's in the application of what you have that where everything can go wrong. And we use shortcuts, and most of the time our shortcuts are helpful because we can't use our minds also for everything at the same time. We have limited capacity in our intelligence, our highest form of cognition. And so we tend to not use, we tend to try to work on automatic pilot most of the time so we can save our precious amount of top-notch cognitive capacity. And as a result, a lot of times we are using automatic associative thinking, we call it. And that means you can be taken in by all kinds of stuff.
Ray, you've once said that it's not normal to be a skeptic and that it's more normal to be a believer.
Yes, and by the way, my good friend Jim Alcock, I guess you know of him.
Yes.
He's writing a book now, which is a fantastic book, you know, that's really covering everything, on belief. Systems. So and I've been reviewing it, helping him. He sends me chapters as he writes them. It's going to be a big book, mm-hmm. Writes on belief. But anyway, he's a good source to understand also why smart people can go wrong, you know, and why people get to believe weird things. He uses in his book, the reason I brought up his book that he's writing, he brings up this thing which we all know, going all the way back to the philosopher Spinoza. Spinoza says that whatever someone tells us, our first thing we do is we believe it, mm-hmm. And then we then spend more time. We have to spend a lot of think on it, but then we if we spend more time with it, we can poke holes in it or say, you know, defend it or actually change our minds. But the normal thing, the normal state for the way the mind works is that whenever it encounters a new statement, it believes it until it then thinks further about it. But the problem is that we really think further about it. We accept quite a bit of number of stuff without thinking about it. So that almost any time we come across any statement, the normal default is for us to believe it, whatever someone says. And if we're not consciously then trying to check it and work at it to see whether it really is true, then this becomes part of our makeup. We can't, our belief system, and we have a lot of beliefs like that because they came in at a time we were distracted or we weren't paying attention or we weren't trying to test it. And once it gets in there as something we believe, then it gets more powerful. In other words, it becomes part of our belief system. This little notion that the first tendency is to believe something and then later check it out can count for a lot of ways why really people can get to believe things. By the way, the most important implications of it, and we have a lot of research on it, is the misinformation effect. That you can give people the experiments they do to show it, is they give people a lot of statements to look at, you know, and judge whether they're true or false, okay? Then the next week or something like that, after some time interval, they'll give the people a list of statements again, like 100 or so, and ask them to judge whether these are true or false. Without telling the people that, half the statements they give them are ones they repeated from the original list, and the other half are new ones. And they keep doing this over a long span of time. And it turns out that just the ones that you've seen, even though originally you didn't believe them, that you've seen them repeated several times, is enough so that their truth value goes up. And so simply repeating misinformation again and again and again, advertisers know this all over again. But we have very strong psychological studies now which show that that creates, that increases your belief in it. So if we just want to spread lies or stuff like that, we just repeat it over and over again. And because you forget where the source is, it's called source amnesia. And the reason that it's in your mind and you can recall it easily, that gets you to believe that this must be true. And as a result of that, just exposing people to anything for a lot of time will get them to later believe that this must be very true.
So much of what we consume now, the data, the amount of information that's being sent to us through our telephones, through our browsers, and through the media, all these things, there seems to be not enough vetting of information. And the everything's about get the news out first and then figure out if it's true later.
That's right.
Right.
And so that's problematic. That's, I think, more my concern.
What can people who self-identify as skeptics do to stem the tide of this nonsense or to counteract these tendencies towards irrationality that seem to be part of the human condition?
Well, to me, the biggest problem facing us, our society as a whole anyway, is misinformation. And unfortunately, there's what we call there's a backfire effect. When you're trying to discredit something that's nonsense, the very fact that you're talking about it reinforces the belief in it, that will create the belief. It's a catch-22 type of thing. Mm-hmm. So that if I'm going to debunk, I'm trying to debunk John Edward, and the more I talk about him, though, that itself is reinforcing that it must be true. He must be true. It strengthens people's belief in it. They forget the source of where it came from, but what happens is that becomes something that's easily retrievable from their memory. They don't remember where it came from. And as a result, if things are easily retrievable from our memory, we tend to believe that it must be so. And this is, again, goes back to the way, if you want to spread a lot of misinformation, you keep repeating, like the truther thing that they repeated of for Obama, that, you know, that he wasn't born in America. And you keep repeating that, people, all kinds of people tend to believe it so now. And it's very hard to undo. Mm-hmm. Even though, finally, Trump, who started it all, nomination campaign, finally admitted that it wasn't true. But it's too late.
Yep. Well, Ray, we could talk with you for hours. We've really been enjoying chatting with you about these topics. We've got a final question that we like to ask all of our guests, and that is, what's your favorite monster?
Well, you know, when you warned me, you gave me a heads up that this is what you're going to do. You're going to ask me that question.
Yes.
I really looked scared. I worked hard and hard and hard. I couldn't think of anything. And finally, I did come up with my favorite monster is the Loch Ness Monster, because this monster has lasted for a long time and will last forever, I suspect.
That's a
great monster.
Yeah, she's popular. I don't think we've put any statistics together on what people have chosen, but she's up there. She's very high on the list. People like her a lot. I like her a lot.
Yeah, how can you not? It's a nice answer.
Ray, thank you so much for spending some time with us. I could talk to you for another evening.
I think we'll have to have Ray back sometime.
You're welcome. Sorry, we got all these glitches. That's fine. That's par for the course.
Yeah, I think we got them ironed out. Yeah, we'll have to have you back
Absolutely.
On the show.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
Monster Talk, the science show about monsters, is an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. The opinions expressed on this show are those of my guests or the hosts and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. If you'd like to know the official opinions of those organizations, you can concentrate carefully until your inexpensive cutlery bends itself into the shapes of letters revealing their secret plans. Or you could just download the app, an ad for which appears after this outro. Today, you heard an interview with psychologist Ray Hyman. Links to the many topics and books he discussed are in the show notes at monstertalk.org. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. There we have links to our Patreon pages as well as a donation button. A great way to support the show is to buy us books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle, and we can share our digital library with each other. Finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please, share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Thank you so much to the many people who have decided to support us on Patreon or send us books to research future topics. 2017 has been an incredibly busy and stressful time for us already, but your support has been a much-needed encouragement. We thank you. I'm looking forward to reading some of these amazing books to help us with future episodes. Intro music for this episode was Dark Walk by Kevin MacLeod. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thanks again for listening.
Did you know that you can now subscribe to Skeptic Magazine digitally? Just grab our free Skeptic Magazine app, currently compatible with iOS, Android, PC, Mac, Kindle Fire, Kindle Fire HD, and BlackBerry Playbook. Head over to skeptic.com/magazine/app to find out more, and download more of your favorite Skeptic content.